Public Radio. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Welcome to a special first-in-the-nation primary edition of The Exchange. This hour, we're sitting down with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. Kasich is also a former congressman, former chair of the House Budget Committee, and served 18 years on the Armed Services Committee. He also ran briefly in the New Hampshire primary before, in 1999, but soon dropped out and supported the candidacy of George W. Bush. Now Kasich is back a decade and a half later with a lot more government experience on his resume. But in this election cycle, those years in office don't appear to be what many GOP voters are seeking, preferring candidates from outside the political system. Still, Kasich seems to be hoping that they'll change their minds, calling some of the outsiders' plans silly and saying philosophy doesn't work when you're trying to get something done. Today in The Exchange, Governor Kasich is here in our studio, and we have a live audience of members of the Concord Young Professionals Network. They'll be submitting their questions. I'm joined by Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter. We'll both be asking Governor Kasich questions as well. And Josh, I'm going to throw it to you first for the first question.
Welcome, Governor. Today there's news of Kurdish forces backed by U.S. airstrikes cutting off the road to Mosul in Iraq, a city now controlled by ISIS. The ISIS forces there are reportedly better equipped than the Kurds. This raises the question of U.S. policy towards ISIS. Are airstrikes enough in your mind, and at what point would ground troops be appropriate?
Well, Josh, first of all, I think that you have to do this in a coalition, and I've been talking about this for a long period of time. I don't think the U.S. should kind of just ease their way into this. I think we should be with a coalition of people, and we should go and take ISIS out as quickly as we possibly can. And if it involves, and it's going to have to involve boots on the ground, but we shouldn't go alone. It should be with a broad coalition of people. And in terms of Syria, I'm very nervous about the president beginning to commit people there because I can't quite figure out what he's doing. What I don't want to do in Syria is get ourselves in the middle of a civil war. We really should have been helping the opposition to Assad a long time ago. We didn't do it. And whenever you delay, you create big problems. In the meantime, I'd create a no-fly zone on the Turkish border and one on the Jordanian border. And we can support the people who are fighting against Assad. And I believe we should be supportive of the Kurds. But this sort of fragmented policy, I just don't understand it. And if you're going to get involved militarily, you go to get in and win and accomplish your objective.
Well, on the no-fly zone, obviously we've got Russian planes there. How ready, you know, would President Kasich be to shoot down one of those planes if it violated that no-fly zone? And how ready do you think the American public would be for that sort of action?
Well, first of all, I'm not going to comment directly on what you said the action would be, but let me put it to you this way, because I believe this is what a leader does, particularly in the area of national security. When we create a no-fly zone, which also doubles as a sanctuary for people who are fleeing the violence and want to protect their families, you might be able, if I were president, you could probably fly in the no-fly zone once and fly out. But if you flew in a second time, you would not be flying out. It's just that simple.
While we're on the subject of Syria, you said you agree with President Obama's decision to accept refugees that have been displaced by the fighting there. Last week, reports are that the administration might increase that number potentially dramatically, and they've been working to speed up the screening to get more refugees processed more quickly. What do you think about that?
Well, Josh, you know, I guess the Germans are going to take about 500,000. This is fundamentally a European problem. But, you know, we're going to want the Europeans to help us at some point. And frankly, we ought to have a much deeper relationship in a whole variety of ways, which is why the people in Finland and in the Baltics are getting nervous about whether anybody would stand with them if, in fact, the Russians were to move in a deliberate way against them. I believe that, you know, it's always a two-way street. So I do think that we should play a role in settling some of these folks. But what I will tell you is I'm deeply troubled when we have some of our folks who are involved in the National Security Agency saying, we don't know if we can properly screen these people. Originally, it was 10,000. I said it was fine. But based on the condition, really, that we will know who they are, because what we don't want to do is to invite ISIS into our country. And there are going to be news going to be coming out today of an arrest in my state, which is very concerning, and connected to an allegiance to ISIS. So we should do our role. We should do our part. It is not fundamentally our problem, but we have to participate, but on the condition, of course, that we can properly screen.
So in terms of the refugees, Governor Kasich, 10,000 sounds okay. Is there a number that you think would be too many? Hillary Clinton, for example, has said 65,000. Europeans, as you said, are taking on many. Is there a number at which you say, uh-uh?
I'm not prepared to say that. I mean, I think the number that was originally set sounded pretty good, but we got to know who they are. I mean, when you have high-level security people saying, we're not sure we can find out who these folks are, then we got to slow down. Now, let's solve the first problem. Let's meet the original number if we can solve that problem and see where we then are.
In terms of boots on the ground, getting back to some of Josh's earlier questions, Governor Kasich, how robust an effort do you envision, especially given, a war-weary American public? We're still extricating ourselves from Afghanistan. We're trying to get out of Iraq. So how much of an effort do you envision, and how do you convince the public to go along with you?
Well, first of all, as the commander-in-chief, and I served on the Defense Committee for 18 years, and I've, of course, been engaged in the issue of international affairs all of my adult lifetime. I mean, one of my senior advisors is the former National Security Advisor to President Reagan. I do it a little bit differently because I didn't need to have people come in and instruct me, but they can come and help me think through some of these things. I mean, when you serve on that committee with people like Barry Goldwater or John Stennis, John Tower, Gary Hart, I mean, you got some of the finest minds, and I had an opportunity to work with them for nearly 20 years. So you sort of understand foreign policy, and over the course of that, you begin to decide what you should do and what you shouldn't do. And for example, I don't like the idea of getting in the middle of a civil war. I don't think that works in our interests. Can we support people who share our objectives in a civil war? Yes, we can, and that's what we should have been doing in Syria. But we don't want to get ourselves in the middle of a civil war directly. Now, when it comes to the issue of ISIS and what it would take, as a commander in chief, I'm prepared to move against them. But I'm not the military strategist. And how do you find good military strategists? Well, you get some of your traditional types. You get some military officials who think differently. You have civilian people who study these issues for a very long period of time. You put them in a room. You sit with them and you say, give me a plan, or give me a couple plans, and then let me decide. So what the forces would look like would depend on how many were with us and what it will take. But I'm not here to try to determine what the numbers ought to be, or that's just a question that I don't think a commander-in-chief should answer, but a commander-in-chief absolutely has to be in the middle of the final decision and the construction of that decision.
To the second part of my question, Governor Kasich, again, the public, weary of war, doesn't want to lose more, blood and treasure. We've put a lot into the Middle East over the past decade and a half. How do you convince people to go along with that?
Well, because, I mean, first of all, leadership is leading. I mean, it's, a leader walks a lonely road. It's if you're going to be worried about public opinion polls and focus groups, that's not the way to lead. That doesn't mean that you don't pay attention to it. You have to pay attention to it, but it isn't the order of the day. What do I think? I think most people in this country have a sense that you're either going to go and defeat ISIS now, and it's going to cost you something now, or it's going to cost you a lot more later. Because these people are intent on just destroying our very way of life. We have a lot of women sitting here, and the way they treat women as possessions. I mean, it's abhorrent what you see happening with the ISIS group. So I just think we've got to act sooner than later, because their battle is not just in the Middle East. It's basically against Western civilization, and I don't think we can tolerate it.
Well, obviously, you've said that the war against ISIS is not simply a military one, but an intellectual one. What do you mean by that, and how do you wage that fight?
Well, what I said is you can win battles with bullets, but you win wars with ideas. And I don't think that we've really engaged as aggressively as we need to on the war of ideas. I mean, what is the Western ethic? What does it stand for? It stands for human rights, particularly the rights of women. It stands for the rule of law. It stands for basic human freedoms. And frankly, when we think about the great religions of the world, the Christian, the Jewish, the Muslim religion, I mean, we've got to make sure that we, as people who believe in a higher power, are able to communicate what that means to people who are out there who get all the radicalized ideas constantly bombarding them. I mean, one of the other problems we have is with the Saudis. You know, we've kind of coddled them for years. We shouldn't make them an enemy by any stretch. But the idea that they fund these madrasas where they then teach people to be radicalized clerics to preach hatred against the West, it has to stop. So my view is, a whole variety from, you know, the old concept of Radio Free Europe with the Western ethic and those who believe in peaceful resolution and human rights. We need to be telling people that in these areas where people are increasingly radicalized. And frankly, to some degree, I think it's also important, even in our own country, to make sure that people are not isolated, that we have to be aware. When you think about people from Starkville, Mississippi, soon out of college, is my understanding, trying to figure out a way to make their way to Syria to join ISIS, it should stop us. It should give us a moment to stop and say, why is this happening? And part of it is because, and you know, maybe some people wouldn't like this, you don't have to think the way that I think, but I happen to believe that faith in a higher power and that we have a responsibility to live a life a little bigger than ourselves and to be a center of justice and healing is an important message. Now, if you don't happen to believe in that Jewish-Christian concept and you're a humanist, you still have the same sense of the fact that you want to heal the world. And it is really, really important that people in America feel a sense of hope, that their life means something. And I think the draw of some of these radicals are communicated to people who are not certain about their own lives. And that's something we have to think about.
You're listening to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers, and we're here with a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. We'll be taking their questions in just a moment, but Josh, first back to you.
So, Governor, let's turn to immigration. You've said we need to get control of the border, but if people here illegally are by paying attention to the laws, they might be able to remain and gain legal status. What I want to ask you about is the deferral programs for illegal immigrants, DACA. President Obama has used it to shield, I think, around 700,000 young immigrants from potential deportation. If the U.S. doesn't pass a new immigration policy by law that sets up a DACA alternative, would you end it?
Well, look, I mean, I've been very clear on immigration. I don't think anybody has been more clear in the Republican Party than I've been. And so I would consider it to be a very high priority to solve this problem, one of the most important things that we can do within the first 100 days, beyond the budget, creating the jobs, getting things stabilized, and actually creating economic growth. I think we can resolve the immigration issue. And I think it rests on a couple components. One is we need to protect our border. I mean, you know, we lock our doors at night to protect our homes. The country is within its has a duty to protect its own house, to be able to keep people from coming over. And then once you do that, anybody who then comes in my opinion, should go back. But we need a robust guest worker program where people can come in, work, and then go back. I mean, that should be done. And with the 11 million that are here, if they have not been engaged in criminal activity, they should pay a fine and you know, assimilate, and could be some other things that we would say they need to do. But they would then have a path to legalization, not a path to citizenship. And so instead of these fragmented one-way approaches, I'd like to have a comprehensive approach. So what do I think about that idea? I think it can pass, okay? I think the public will accept it, and I think it can pass a Congress.
Why do you think it hasn't thus far?
Leadership. I mean, seriously, we have not seen the leadership that you need out of an administration that needs to know. Look, you got to work with people.
But I mean, getting through the House?
Well, I think you can get a coalition of people that pass it. I mean, that's what leadership for me is the ability to get people to do the things that they know they should do, but that they don't want to do. And I happen to believe, maybe I'm wrong about it, but I happen to believe that the public understands that a reasonable approach to this, a definitive approach, as long as we're not saying, well, the border's not important, I think the people will support this. I really do. And I think you can put a coalition together to get it done. I think you can get a coalition together to do a variety of things. I've done it in my career on a whole variety of issues. And if I didn't think that, why would I be doing this? You know, I don't want a talk show. I've already had one. And I don't need to write a book. I've already written three. So, you know, this is something that I'm trying to do for my country.
But, I mean, if you couldn't get it through quickly, would you use executive power to do what you thought was right in the way that the president has?
Well, look, I've used executive power in Ohio. Ohio has a very powerful executive. And there are things that I've done where I was able to use my authority. But you don't use authority in a vacuum. In other words, I've used some executive authority, but in the course of doing it, I've quietly checked with the people who are the leaders in the legislature and told them what I was going to do and even sought their advice in some cases about how do you think I should approach this. And sometimes, you know, legislators kind of like you to do that. You know, then they don't have to vote on things that they consider to be thorny. To be honest with you, that's sort of the way life works. Now, if you've ever been an executive, you probably wouldn't understand it. And if you've only been a political science major, that's a turnoff. But I'm just talking to you about the way things get done. And so my sense is that I don't think you resort to that. I'll give you another one. Whenever you're an executive and you use the word veto, it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull, okay? Now, there are ways to communicate.
Do you say you have serious concerns about a proposal? As a code for, you know, signaling that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's lots of ways in which you communicate your displeasure, okay? And sometimes you do it quietly, you know, I'm not going to get into all this, but we had a bill moving that I thought was going to move through our legislature that was going to weaken the opportunity to really fix failing public schools. And I made a couple phone calls to a couple people I know, and, you know, I told them kind of in direct terms how I felt about it, and I don't think those bills are going to pass. So there's ways you do it without embarrassing people or backing them into a corner, and that's kind of what you do. You know, if you look, and I'm for vetoing. I mean, I vetoed, a few 40 items or something the last time. A lot of it was stuff that really had no business being in there, and some of it was put in there with the intention that I would veto it. But what I'm saying to you is that veto is a sign in many respects of failure, and I'd rather communicate and work things out than end up getting into that kind of a situation.
Well, and coming up, we'll talk about your political experience that you're highlighting there in Ohio.
Okay, Laura, thank you.
Why some Republican voters this time around seem less interested in political experience, why they're gravitating toward some of the outsiders in this race. And we'll start taking some questions from our live audience here in Studio D at NHPR. So stay with us. More with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich in a moment. This is a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers, and we're here with a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. We'll take their questions in just a moment. Governor Kasich, though, first, let's dig into your political outlook for a moment and how yours fits in with your fellow Republican contenders. There are a lot of them this year. Toward that end, I want to play a clip from comments you made in Ohio earlier this fall.
I've about had it with these people. And let me tell you why. We got one candidate that says that we ought to abolish Medicaid and Medicare. You ever heard of anything so crazy as that? Telling our people in this country who are seniors or about to be seniors that we're going to abolish Medicaid and Medicare? We got one person saying we ought to have a 10% flat tax that will drive up the deficit in this country by trillions of dollars that my daughters will spend the rest of their lives having to pay off. You know, what I say to them is, why don't we have no taxes? Just get rid of them all, and then a chicken in every pot on top of it. We got one guy that says we ought to take 10 or 11 million people and pick them up. I don't know where we're going to go, in their homes, their apartments,
We're going to pick them up and we're going to take them to the border and scream at them to get out of our country? I mean, that's just crazy. That is just crazy. We got people proposing health care reform that's going to leave, I believe, millions of people without adequate health insurance. What has happened to our party? What has happened to the conservative movement?
And Governor Kasich, I'd love to throw that question to you.
Straight talk.
Yeah. Well, tell us what you think has happened to the conservative movement.
Well, look, what I'm most concerned about is that we are reform-oriented, growth-oriented, opportunity-oriented, but realistic and practical about the way you do things. And look, I happen to be a conservative Republican. I don't know who's sitting in here. We probably have it. My dad was a Democrat, but he was a conservative. I don't know who's in here. But for my party, for the philosophy that I believe in government as a last resort and not a first resort, I don't want us to come up with ideas that come the fall, people are going to look carefully at and just say, well, that's not doable. I mean, when you start talking about seriously shipping 10 or 11 million people and maybe creating some kind of a deportation task, you know, some kind of a group that I'm hearing talked about now, I don't think that works. I don't think it's practical. And so, you know, I sometimes have to point out the way that I see things. And my mother always used to say, Johnny, tell it like it is. So I do. But look, it's has nothing to do with the people themselves. It has to do with some of the ideas. And I think we have to live in the real world. And I believe at the end, that's where people are going to want to be, Laura. I think people are going to want to be in a position of where they can see that problems are solved. I mean, when you talk about, you know, the outsiders and their support, and we don't like anybody with experience. See, I think in listening to people in town halls and lots of other places, I think there's a couple things to note. One, people think the problems are so big and they think the system is so dysfunctional. It's sort of like, why don't I just go get somebody that's never had anything to do with this? It's sort of like if you have a football team that's 0-8, you start thinking about pulling somebody out of the stands to come in and play football. But you know what happens when game time comes? We make a couple trades. We change the lineup a little bit, but we don't pull people out of the stands. And I think that's what's going to happen ultimately in this political election. I think experience ultimately will be honored as long as the people who have the experience have a history of reform and change. They don't want the same old, same old.
Whatever happened to the conservative movement, that question that you sort of rhetorically asked there, you came into your political being, so to speak, in the 90s, Newt Gingrich, you know.
Well, I was earlier.
And
I
so
came
forth
into my
earlier.
Being,
Ronald Reagan.
Well, I came into my being in 1952. But actually, my first political office, I was a member of the Ohio Senate.
So, but to answer that question, when you were active on Capitol Hill and so forth, you were considered a conservative. Now in this race, you're considered a moderate. So what does that say about your party?
Well, I think it says to some degree that maybe I haven't communicated effectively enough of what my record is. I mean, so let's just say that you are a political scientist, and I'm going to prove it to you. So, I was involved in one of the chief architects of balancing the federal budget. Conservative, yes. Cutting taxes, the capital gains tax in Washington, one of the biggest tax cuts in history. Conservative, yes. Reforming welfare. I was involved. I wasn't a chief architect, but I was involved in the reform of welfare. Conservative, check. Become governor of Ohio. I cut taxes by $5 billion. That's more than any sitting governor. Is that conservative? Check. The lowest number of state employees in 30 years. Is that conservative? Check. I can go on here. Our pension systems under control? Absolutely rock solid. Our credit rising? Absolutely. But the other thing about who I am is with this growing prosperity, because we're up 347,000 jobs, we're running surpluses now, okay? I just have also believe that we need to provide opportunity to people who, you know, are having a tough time, the drug addicted, the mentally ill, the working poor, the developmentally disabled.
And that's where moderate label comes in.
Maybe. And, you know, this little young boy that came in, you know why he was here? I met him outside standing in the rain. He's got cerebral palsy. You know, he's such a sweet kid, and you just want hopes and prayers that he's going to have a great life. And I have a big heart for that. And I'm thankful the Lord planted that in me, and that's the way I am. Now, does that make you a liberal? I don't see. That's where I say, what's happened to my party? Because I met Reagan. I knew Reagan. I actually worked with Reagan. Okay, he had a big heart. He wanted people to have an opportunity. Now, my mother used to say, Johnny, it's a sin not to help people who need help, but it's equally a sin to continue to help people who need to learn how to help themselves. And we're reforming our welfare programs in Ohio to demand personal responsibility. I'm not going to change to win an election, folks. I'm just not. This is who I am, and changing is not an option for me. I'm a pretty happy with myself, and I'm a very happy guy and have had a lot of blessings and a great family and a great career. And if this doesn't work out, I'll still come back to see the leaves.
All right, Governor, Ohio's a big state. To run it, you have to work with Democrats. You don't always get what you want, but you try. I get most of what I want.
I do.
Yeah, and you know, an example of something you tried to get was a bill that you passed in 2011 that, among other things, limited collective bargaining rights for public sector unions. Voters overturned that by referendum. It was a high-profile defeat. You obviously bounced back. But you know, what did you learn from that?
What I learned is what I've always known in life. When you try big things, you don't always succeed. That doesn't matter. But we learned a lot. We gained a lot, too, because we were able to get our state workforce into very good shape and to be in a position of where they were paying some of their health care and their retirement costs. We were pleased about that. And what else did I learn? It was really early. It was really early in my term. And I don't want to tell you how it all worked out, but to be honest with you, we would have done things a little different had I had a little bit more experience. But, you know, the other thing is when you lose, be gracious in defeat. You know, you take the defeat. Now, here's the amazing thing. When I ran for reelection, I had the operating engineers, the building trades, and the carpenters all endorse me. And I have a very good relationship with organized labor. And what I've told them is, look, you want to, if you impede economic growth, we're going to have a problem. But if you don't and we work together, we can have a good relationship. And so, by the way, I was at a low point. I was in the, you know, like 30% approval or something. I was the most unpopular governor in America. But after fixing the economy and getting all these things done, I won 86 out of 88 counties, the second largest electoral victory in modern history, 60% of women, 51% of union households, and 26% of African Americans. It was a smashing win. Why? Two reasons. Economy doing better. Secondly, I think reaching out to people who do live in the shadows, I think they said, well, you know, maybe the guy gets it.
And well, so, Governor Kasich, I want to go to our audience here. I know people have submitted questions, and we'd love to hear from them. Again, we've got an audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network with us. And first person, go ahead. Thanks for being here. Give us your name and go ahead with your question, please.
Hi, I'm Mary Lou. Good afternoon, Governor. Even as the economy begins to improve, many Granite Staters still feel like they're on shaky ground. For too many workers, wages are stagnant, and for working parents, the cost of quality childcare is nearly as high as college tuition. As the next president, what will you do to help working families succeed at the American dream?
Well, I mean, number one is we clearly have to have a far more robust economy. This has been the most anemic economic recovery since World War II. And with a more aggressive recovery, I believe we can see a lot more investment by businesses, not only the startup of new businesses, but investment in current businesses. And when businesses invest with plant and equipment, we begin to see workers have higher productivity. With higher productivity comes higher wages. In addition to that, you know, we're talking about child care. You know, the early childhood education is important. Our K-12 education system is important. And basically, we need to start changing the agrarian model and start trying to tailor education or customize education for people's, you know, their skills, their God-given purpose. And training is a lifetime endeavor. So what would I do about that specifically? We have 104 programs in Washington in the Department of Education. I would bundle them up into four buckets, and I would send them to the states. And as president, I would travel the country talking about the best practices for making sure that people have skills. You know, to some degree, our education is training people for a 20th century economy rather than for a 21st century economy, because our education system is not evolving as quickly as it should. But that's up to you. You live here in New Hampshire. You can run for school board. You can become a community, a person out there that wants to engage in the schools. And I think that's really important. So K through 12 education. Secondly, higher education. The community college experience and the four-year experience is really important as well. But we need to focus on getting students to graduate in areas where there's jobs. Because a lot of times we train people for jobs that don't exist. We've changed that in Ohio. We had to change it in the country. So education would come back to the states, and then job training. We have to have lifetime education anymore. People have to constantly improve their skills. They have to constantly get in a position of where they become a more and more valuable employee. So that's lifelong education, using our community colleges to constantly work with employers to train, and getting job training money back to the states to apply it for what works for you is a lot better, because right now the federal government fundamentally says you have to lose your job before we train you. Well, why don't we let you get trained while you're on the job so you don't lose your job, so we don't have to train you for another job?
So would President Kasich invest more in education? This sounds like
spending. Well, K-12 education is a state and local. Money can't buy you love. I mean, you know, money can't buy you everything. If you don't have enough money, your education system won't work. But just because you have money doesn't mean it works. No, I think what it gets down to is all of you to disrupt in a positive way the kind of education that's occurring in your state. In Massachusetts, they have imposed very high standards on students, and you're seeing really good results. You're not seeing the number of remedial. You graduate from high school today, you get accepted to college, and 40% of our students are taking remedial education. Let us fix these schools, but you got to fix them. And I believe in local control of schools. I would get the federal dollars back to you, but fundamentally, K-12 education is right here. It's in Ohio, it's in New York, it's in New Hampshire, and that's the change that has to occur.
High standards sounds like an endorsement for Common Core, yes, no?
Well, let me tell you what that subject means in my state. In my state, it means high standards with curriculum designed by local school boards. That, to me, is what it's all about. It's making sure that we have high standards and not low standards so we all think we live in Lake Wobegon because all of our kids make A's. I'd rather know how my kids are doing. And so high standards, it should be the order of the day. A lot of people don't like high standards because it starts to show that, well, you know, maybe you're not an A student like you thought you were, but that's a good thing because then we can work on trying to get people to understand how they can do better in school.
All right.
Look, and as a parent of, as a dad of two almost 16-year-olds, I'm on that education all the time.
You're listening to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. I'm Laura Kanoy along with Josh Rogers. We're here with a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. We have another question from our audience. Thank you for that one earlier. And thank you for coming out. Go ahead and ask your question.
Hi. I'm a graduate of one of your fine universities in Ohio, so thank you. The consensus of climate scientists is that human-caused climate change is real and an unprecedented threat to humanity. If you agree, what do you propose the U.S. do to both mitigate it and to prepare for its impacts?
Well, you know, this may be another one of those reasons why they call me a moderate. I don't know. I do believe there is climate change, and I think that human beings impact it. But I also don't know to what degree we impact it. So what I do, I'll tell you what my philosophy is that we are here to take care of the environment, but not to worship the environment. And I think sometimes we can find environmentalists who are extreme. And I will tell you another thing. Sometimes we find them in a position of where they complain no matter what we do because they get to be able to raise money by saying how bad everything is. Now, I work with them also, and we, in fact, we're in a position in Lake Erie where we don't allow manure to be put on frozen ground where it can flow into the lake and cause these algae blooms. And when I did it, we both had the Farm Bureau and the Environmental Council all supporting this. In the area of fracking, I believe in fracking. I believe in developing natural gas. But we also have some of the toughest rules in the country. They're clear. They're not complicated, but they're tough. We want to make sure we take care of groundwater, that we want to make sure we know what the chemicals are. And in terms of Ohio, we've had a 30% reduction in emissions over the last 10 years. What do I think ultimately the answer is? I think it is all of the above. I think it's clean coal, it's natural gas, it's nuclear, but it's also the renewables. And I want to make sure that we have a renewable standard in Ohio that fits Ohio. In other words, I don't want us to have to buy out of state power. Because we can't produce the sort of solar and wind that we need, but I want to have it. I want to have make sure that we are on the path to being part of the renewable development in this country.
Well, thank you for the question, okay. And Josh, I'll throw it back to you.
Sure. You've made balancing the federal budget a priority. You released a plan that you say can bring the budget into balance in 8 years. It drops some tax rates. It gets rid of the estate tax. Adds some benefits for low-income folks, among other things. Freezes non-defense spending and would boost defense spending aggressively, 17%, I think. How much revenue growth would you need to pull all that off?
Well, we would get to a balanced budget over, you know, by the end of a second term. First of all, the way you balance a budget is both with economic growth, which is what happened in Washington and which what's happened in Ohio. So tax cuts are important because they can help spur economic growth. You've got to make sure, though, that the calculations that you do are not fanciful. You know, you can't say, well, we're going to have economic growth at 10% or something like that, and that's going to heal everything. You need to have a reasonable amount of tax cutting while at the same time a reasonable amount of government restraint. And you put those two things together in our package along with a change in the regulatory environment. You get about 3.9% growth, and you can get the balance by the end of a second term.
And you think history would bear out that 3.9% growth is?
Oh, it would. I mean, I don't make numbers up. Yeah, I mean, I've written more budgets than you've been alive. No, not serious. I've written about 18 budgets in my lifetime, and just kidding you. That's a joke, folks. So anyway, well, you never know in these days what people consider a joke or not. But no, I wouldn't put that on paper if I didn't think it would work. And no, I believe that we could get there. We could actually get there perhaps a little bit sooner, but I'm not going to say that because I'm not certain of it.
Coming up, more of our conversation with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. Welcome back to a special first-in-the-nation primary edition of The Exchange with Ohio Governor and Republican presidential candidate John Kasich. I'm Laura Kanoy. Along with Josh Rogers, we're here with a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. And Governor Kasich, I want to turn to the subject of your religious faith and how it shapes your politics. And you've mentioned this a couple times already this hour. Let's hear you talking about this at the Faith and Freedom Conference in D.C. in June.
Worldly criticism doesn't matter a whole lot to me. You see, I know that the role that I have to play on earth to lift people, to realize that all those who are made of the image of the Lord need to be upheld. We know we need to love our enemies. Boy, that's a hard one. We know we have to be humble. We know we have to stand for the poor and the bereaved and the widowed.
So, Governor Kasich, how does that translate into governing, or how does it translate into running for office?
Well, I don't consult the scripture when I decide what I have to do legislatively. but look, I mean, there's a sort of a perspective you get. And I got to tell you, honestly, sometimes you lose it. I believe that life is short. It's fleeting. And I just as I said, I think we have a responsibility to live a life that's greater than ourselves. But I don't mean that to say that if you don't happen to think the way that I do on this matter, that somehow you're less moral or less whatever. But I do think we all have to realize that however you feel about a life yet to come, while we're here, we need to make sure that we do really good things, and not just for ourselves, but for people that are around us, and to be a center of healing in whatever way we can. I will tell you that if you search both the Old and the New Testament, it is very clear about our the importance of people who are down, the people who are poor, the people who are widowed. And so, you know, that's a value that I learned that really as a kid from my mom and from my dad. But, you know, my sense is do the best I can while I'm here and hopefully finish the race strong. But you know, I will bet me more flawed than everybody else sitting in this room. I just know that I get a mulligan every day to live a better life.
Well, you said it's a perspective, and sometimes you lose it. When do you lose it?
When you know there's a magnet in this world, and it pulls you down to be thinking the only thing that matters is this world, and those are my worst days. My best days, I have a perspective that my life is very important, that the lives of people around me are very important, but you know there's a life yet to come. And so when I have that perspective and realize that I'm not in control, but there's a higher power than me in control, I'm a lot happier. I have a lot more perspective. And you know what else? I love talking about this because my life has gotten better the more I have put energy into thinking about all these things.
Josh? Well, go ahead. This does remind me of one more policy issue.
Yeah.
Excuse me on that. You've related this to Medicaid expansion, that it's part of your mission, part of your faith to take care of the poor and the dispossessed. And yet some of your fellow Republicans have said, no, Medicaid expansion is part of the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. We should not be supporting this. We should be repealing it. How do you sort of work your way through that? And again, we keep talking about you having that moderate label. Maybe that's another reason why.
Well, look, I mean, Ronald Reagan expanded Medicaid either 3 or 4 times. And we have reduced the growth of Medicaid from 10% down to 2.5% in my second budget by reforming things. I expanded Medicaid not just because I have a concern about the poor, but also because there's a practical side of this. I can treat the drug addicted, the mentally ill, and keep them out of prison. We have 27% recidivism rate compared to a 47% national average. So if I can get people out of prison, because that's where a lot of them are, and I can get them working, I get a twofer. I not only save money for putting them in prison at $22,500 a year, but then they become a tax-paying citizen. It's a great idea. And with the working poor, you know, they're in the emergency room. And, you know, when they go to the emergency room, they cost more, and guess who pays for it? We do. So it's a dollars and cents plus, you know, a values issue for me. And I tell people, if you don't want to do it the way I did it, that's cool. But, you know, we don't want to take people who are schizophrenic and lock them in a prison. I mean, nobody should be doing that. And we made a promise to the mentally ill when we closed our institutions down that we would take care of them in the community level. And by and large, we have not. And so we need to fix that.
All right. Back to you, Josh, and then we'll go back to our audience. Go ahead.
Well, the most recent Republican debate, you call that Wall Street for being too greedy. And you said you believe free enterprise is great, but it needs to be based on values. And you spoke of Wall Street needing, I think the term was ethics lessons. How do you make that sort of thing happen?
Well, look, I think it gets the leadership in everything, Josh. It's the leadership of somebody that runs an NFL team or owns an NFL team. I mean, you know, to me, it's an outrage that this guy down in Dallas is playing football. Hardy, I think, is his name. I mean, come on. This guy shouldn't be playing football. I mean, say we're going to rehab him, fine. But, you know, you beat up your wife or your girlfriend. I mean, you know, there's like a moral part of that. But I think it's true in everything. I think it's true in politics. I think it's true in the entertainment industry. And on Wall Street, look, leadership can say you don't get people to do bad deals because you're going to make some money. And you don't get people to pile up more debt after more debt that could come tumbling down. It's leadership, and it's a sense that I have a responsibility. So I love the free enterprise system. It's rescued more people from poverty than any system known by man. But you also have to have a little values connected to it, you know, like how do you treat your neighbor? How would you want them to treat you? This isn't any deep, sort of religious or spiritual thing. It's like common sense about how you should conduct your life. And
you worked at Lehman Brothers.
I did.
I mean, did you see this sort of thing there?
Sure, I did. Yeah. And I saw good people there. And, the fact is that we all have to answer for how we look at life and how we want to be a role model for our children, too. Did I see people there that were greedy? Absolutely. But I wasn't running it. I had a 2-man office in Columbus, Ohio, and one of them accused me of bankrupting Lehman Brothers. If I bankrupted Lehman from a 2-man office, I should be Pope, not president, you know. So, I don't think there's – the government should have – I mean, there are regulations that we can put into place that can help to manage the financial crisis. But at the end, government, it can't be imposing, you know, like you got to be more honest. I mean, that's part of why I believe in the Judeo-Christian ethic, because what it does is it self-guides us, that when we realize we answer to a higher power, then we can be in a position of where we sort of self-regulate rather than to legislate, because the legislation is always frustrating. And it doesn't mean you shouldn't have any, but by and large, it's self-regulation in a free society.
But Governor Kasich, you know, a lot of people in those banks that were too big to fail and so forth that angered the American public so much, you know, they didn't seem to be guided by some of the same principles that you talk about. So how do you manage that when not everybody sees the world
you do? The regulators, not only did they not bark, but they didn't bite. Fannie and Freddie were convincing people they should buy things that they couldn't afford, which is wrong. And then on top of it, the banks engaged in risky activity. And frankly, what ought to happen is people who are investors in these banks, the debt and the equity owners, if something goes down, they're the ones that have to take the hit. But I don't like the idea of punishing depositors, men and women who work a lifetime. They're just depositors in a bank. But when you've got to have systems in place and rules in place that will protect the public, protect the depositors, and blow an early warning. And so it doesn't mean that it's just a matter of the ethics on Wall Street. There are legitimate rules that ought to be put in place. But you got to make sure the rules you put in place are not killing the small and the community banks. You know, I had a meeting here with bankers here in New Hampshire, and they're like, my God, I'm going to have to sell my bank. The big banks are going to get bigger. Sometimes you regulate improperly, and you end up making things worse.
All right. Well, we could probably talk about that for 20 more minutes.
Let's do another hour.
I do want to go back to our wonderful audience here in Studio D, and thanks for coming out today, and go ahead and ask your question.
Sure. Thanks. Hi. Hello, Governor. My name is Doug Phelan. I'm a family medicine resident here in Concord. And I wanted to thank you first for some of the work you've done with Medicaid expansion and things like that in Ohio. So here in Concord, even with the Affordable Care Act, there's still uninsured and underinsured citizens, to be frank. All sorts of income disparity, but mostly from the lower socioeconomic status. And I'm fortunate enough to take care of them and see them every day and participate in their care. If the ACA were to be repealed and you were to then put a new influx of further than re-uninsured people back into the marketplace, how would Medicaid expansion, value-based care, any of the things that you propose, how would they help cover that gap and give people the care that they deserve and need, as well as keep the system financially solvent?
Well, first of all, Obamacare has imposed higher costs. Insurance costs are going up because they had so many mandates in insurance, which has made it more costly. And the biggest problem with medicine today is that it costs too much. Okay, the rising costs could ultimately, as you would know, result in rationing. And who gets rationed? The people that have the least amount of power. I'm not for that. So what would I do? Well, I would take some of the money that the federal government has right now that's connected to the exchange. I would block grant it to the states. And then I would free up Medicaid so that states could maneuver and manage their poor in a more effective way, which I could do in Ohio. And if there is a need, some state resources that can make sure that people have insurance coverage. So you bring down the cost of insurance, and you have a way in which you have the resources to make sure people can still have health insurance. But then when we talk about value care, you know, if you were to go to the hospital tonight, maybe not you, but probably you, and you needed two tests, they probably give you seven. And so we have a system that rewards quantity and not quality. So I don't know if you're a primary care doctor, but I'd like to put money in your pocket for keeping me healthy. I'd like to put money in your pocket so you to guide me through the system so that I'm not getting things that I don't need at a price that none of us can afford. And I also think that the health plans themselves and the hospitals, I mean, we need them to be more aggressive. The hospitals need to be more transparent. You need to be more transparent as to how you are as a physician. But when we keep people healthy and we get them recovered from illness quicker, there ought to be a financial reward. And I believe those things would lower the cost of health insurance. Now, I wouldn't be for that system if I didn't think my family would prosper under it. But I think the current system is ultimately going to lead us to a rationing that doesn't make any sense. And my concern, by the way, with my colleagues in this race for president, is have a solid plan that can answer these questions.
Don't just say we can have a simple tax credit and it'll take care of everything, or just things like health savings accounts, although I believe in them. You know, it takes a comprehensive plan to make sure people don't get caught out there. So, you know, it takes a comprehensive program to make sure that people can have the kind of health care insurance that they need so the system will work for them and their family.
Well, Governor Kasich, thank you for that question, by the way. And Governor Kasich, we're getting close to the end. Couple more questions. And Josh Rogers, I'll throw it back to you.
Sure.
Can we go 15 more minutes? We're not allowed to do that. I mean, how does it work?
We have to ask you the...
Maybe when we're done, we can take some when we're off the air. How's that? Okay,
we have to ask you the obligatory, how much do you love New Hampshire questions.
Oh, okay.
We often ask at the end.
Well, you know, out on the campaign trail, you, like pretty much most people that are running for president who come through New Hampshire, talk about, you know, New Hampshire is fantastic. It's a wonderful experience. You know, you all have
fanatic. Well, like we don't believe it.
Well, I mean, I don't doubt your sincerity.
Can I tell you
say
why
this
I feel that
times?
Way in a nutshell? It's because I think this is the best way to do it. I trust the people in New Hampshire because it is a state that is diversified. It is a state that is reachable. I mean, you know, you can get to all parts of it, and there's only 1.3 million people. It's like running for Congress in a big district. So, you know, I've been here since I announced. This is my 21st trip. I've done, I don't know, 26, 27 town hall meetings. And you get up, people look at you, they decide whether you make sense, and they make a good recommendation to the country. That's why I like it. It's doable, and it's fun. And, you know, I've been here before, and I've always had pleasant memories of it. And hopefully, when this primary's over, I'll have more pleasant memories. We'll see.
Well, I mean, you've talked about how... you know, you're building a foundation here, and you have the backing of, you know, some well-known Republicans. They don't fit in the young professionals category, most of them. But
you don't know Simon. It's just impossible.
But I mean, how important is New Hampshire for you? I mean,
critical,
is this something that you
critical.
Must, a state you must win?
Well, I must win is it? That's a, you know, you're in the media, so, you know, I have to exceed expectations. And we're planning to do that. I'm going to be in Iowa. It's a caucus, so, you know, that's a different ball game than here. What I like here is it's actually a state primary. Independents can come in and vote. And then you do well enough here, you head to South Carolina and then the South, and that's how it works. But I think a boost out of New Hampshire is absolutely critical. You know, I think you should have a rocket ship on your license plates because you've launched more people into the presidency than about any other state.
Speaking of running,
you like that, huh? I hear a lot of okay, but it's true. I'm not. I mean, do you think I make things up? I take on positions here that makes people uncomfortable, but you know, I know that we need to lead and fix the country, and so I'm not going to go tell you how great you are if I didn't think it. I'm going to tell you it because it's part of my soul. I trust you going forward, whether, you know, in elections yet to come. I trust the people of New Hampshire making a good choice. I think you'd do a good job.
That's reassuring.
Well, it does lead to my last question. How much time are you spending, speaking of New Hampshire, maybe not do or die, but important, how much time are you spending in that other state with the corn? You know which one I'm talking about.
Well, yeah, I'm spending more time there, and I do spend time, but it's not as much as what I spend here. Because the caucus, you know, if it snows in the part of Iowa, you know, you lose the caucus. You know, it's a little bit different when you're talking about a statewide primary. But we're putting time in there. But this is the most of the time that we're spending is here and traveling and raising money and going to debates. And it's a crazy system, but it's actually a lot of fun, as hard as it is to believe.
What are your thoughts, Governor Kasich, on the debates and how they've played out this year with the kids' table debates and the grown-up table debates
look,
and
I
so
love
forth.
This, right? I'm not limited to 30 or 60 or 90 seconds. I get to speak longer, and you get to follow up, and it's not the rush and all that you find in those environments. I think debates are important, but they're only one of a whole series of things that come together to decide who gets picked.
Well, now I feel guilty saying you get to speak longer because I got to let you go now. We've run out of time. Governor Kasich, it's been nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for being
Thank
with us.
You.
We
I
really appreciate it.
Very, very much.
That's Ohio Governor John Kasich, a Republican presidential candidate. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. Thanks to everyone who helped with this special broadcast, including my co-host, Josh Rogers, also senior producer Ellen Grimm, producers Faith Meixel and Daniel Rosinski-Larson, and our volunteer Priscilla Malcolm. Thanks also to technical guys Dan Colgan and Andrew Perella, digital reporter Brian Walston, and program director Mike Rathke, with help from Angie Lane, and especially to our live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is NHPR.